This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The cow goes from KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Stanley Crawford, whose new novel, Petroleum Man, has been published by the Overlook Press. Now, Stanley is a very interesting writer for me, because I started reading his books in around 1969, when a teacher of mine gave me his first novel, Gascoigne. I quickly found travel notes from here to there, and then the number of people who recommended The Log of the SS, the Mrs. Unguentine, included Anne Beattie. Any number of writers would speak to me about that book. His fourth novel, known as Some Instructions, has a long title that I'll ask Stanley to recite.
Okay, here goes. Some instructions to my wife concerning the upkeep of the house and marriage, and to my son and daughter concerning the conduct of their childhood.
Now, he went on, you know, there would be notes in the book saying that he was a garlic farmer in New Mexico, which only added to the antic presence of this author about whom so little was known. His books about those experiences include A Garlic Testament. He went on to be the supervisor of irrigation, and he wrote about it in his book, Mayor Domo. And there is also A River in Winter. But we're here to talk about his fiction. Now, Petroleum Man, the new novel by my guest Stanley Crawford, is being narrated by one of the very richest men in the entire world. And he is writing an ongoing memorial to his cars. I thought we'd begin by hearing the first couple of pages of the book. This is Stanley Crawford reading from the first chapter of his new novel, Petroleum Man.
I will need to put on my Leon Tuggs voice. Leon Tuggs is the narrator here. This is section one, a 1/4, 1/24 scale 1934 Ford sedan. You are both too young, Fabian and Rowena, to realize that this 1/24 scale plastic model is to be the first in a collection composing some 30 items altogether. Indeed, the concept, collection, is still probably beyond you, although if you look around the house of your parents, well, perhaps a better example would be to look around the house of us, your grandparents, and pay attention to that moment when your sticky, grasping hands approach some bright object and you hear the words, "Look, but don't touch, Fabian," which indicates that your still poorly coordinated grasp is threatening to close in on an item of one of my collections, a valuable object, either fragile because made of glass or scratchable because made of silver or gold, or even brass or pewter, or needing to be handled with the greatest of care because of the incredible sharpness of the blade, for example, or because of the remote possibility of the thing going off in your hands. That's what collections are, my little ones. They are things you do not touch until you have reached the age at which you can be fully trusted and are willing to assume responsibility in the event of breakage or some other form of degradation, surely to cause a reduction in value in a collectible. The 1/24 scale replicas I have bestowed on each of you as the first item in your future collections are, for you, briefly touchable, but only under the supervision of your parents, which I have made abundantly clear to them. 1/24-inch scale means that each inch of your model represents 24 inches of the original real full-size vehicle. As very young children, you two are 1/3 and 1/4 scale adults, as it were, by height. I intend to bestow these models on you every 3 to 6 months on the usual holidays, family birthdays, and various corporate milestone dates over the next decade or so, bringing your collection current with what will then be reality, by which time I expect I will have owned some 30 or 40 different types of cars. Assembly of the complete collection will come, in short, during your 14th or 15th year, Fabian, and your 12th and 13th, or 13th, Rowena, and more precisely, God willing, on the occasion of that birthday of mine I have come to think of as the big one. At that time, I will have also completed these reflections on the real full-size cars upon which the models are based, to be jotted down in my private 737 on my frequent business trips during the early morning hours when the rest of the world is sound asleep 30,000 feet below, or at this moment 19,000 feet as we are beginning our descent towards O'Hare. My steward has brought a message from the captain to the effect that we'll be passing through some turbulence in about 5 minutes before touchdown. At any rate, when you have attained the age of mature understanding, I will present both of you copies of this personal guide to your collections, suitably bound in leather, or my estate will.
Stanley Crawford, reading from the first chapter of his new novel, Petroleum Man. Now, in these novels, voices, in this case a rather monstrous voice, are central. And these monsters, when they occur, are unaware, by and large, of their monstrosity. A good part of reading the book is the reader starting to squirm under the ministrations of such an unconscious, unkind voice. Surely, given your background as garlic farmer and irrigation manager, these are not voices that you take to with any warmth. What is it like to be writing and providing yourself with the company of your enemy?
Well, I suppose I should say I regard it as a rather salutary exercise. I wrote, or Leon Tuggs, you might say, came to me and insisted I take down his words because I was at work on another project. And I was at a point of, as I'm sure a lot of people are, various times of their lives, exasperation with what was going on in the country. And it was becoming unbearable. And this was a way to make it bearable, because I'm mocking my own pieties here also. But to assume the voice of your enemy is, of course, a way to know your enemy and understand him, and to a certain extent have compassion for him or her. And but it was difficult. I had to live with this guy for longer than perhaps I wanted to, but we all have to live with these people. They come through us, through the media. They're very present in their institutions, and because they are rich and famous, we hear their voices, we see their images. They're with us.
Now, there seems to be something of an alternation between the voices of power in certain novels and their victims. The loveliest of these books, to my mind, is the log of the SS, the Mrs. Unquintine. She's living in the wake of her husband's death. Her husband prepared to leave the known world by constructing a barge covered by a geodesic dome. It's a kind of mobile floating Eden. And now she can't find him anywhere. And she's speaking of him with a kind of deep, affectionate nostalgia. But once again, the reader is realizing that this missing man, a god of sorts, is something of a tyrant, and that she is lucky, although lonely, to be now inhabiting this lush place that he has constructed for her pleasure, but now she's alone in it. She's the victim, much as the implied family in some instructions are the victim of the instruction, much as Fabian and Rowena are perhaps the indifferent victims of Leon in Petroleum Man. But this alternation between the powerful and the powerless seems to be at the center of your enterprise.
That's an interesting observation. I don't think I've thought of it quite that way. And perhaps it is what has led me in, or led me into nonfiction, which of course emerged from our lives as small-scale organic farmers, and which in turn was a matter of connecting with this little village in northern New Mexico, and getting to know people who were not educated, didn't have the opportunities that I had as a young man, had not traveled widely. But had a sense of character and value. They valued their place. They valued their families, their heritage. Even though at the time in the early 70s, northern New Mexico was still off the map in cultural terms. So that was perhaps helped me fill out the other half of that equation. The ordinary people, the victims, and in many cases the voiceless, as some writers have said.
There is also, in the way that structured in your work, a sense of almost surreal omnipotence, the ability of a man to build a floating jungle for himself and his wife. The boundless wealth of the narrator of Petroleum Man. These seem in my mind to rival the omnipotence of a writer presiding over a world entirely of his own device, or at least potentially so. So there seems to be a collaboration between the imaginative omnipotence of the author and the worldly omnipotence of the robber baron, or the speaker who can do anything to the world, including, in this case, in Petroleum Man, manufacture thingies, which are universally regarded as environmentally destructive. He announces, well, the problem is the environment. but I wanted to ask you about that relationship between the omnipotent author and the omnipotent corrupter of the earth.
Well, again, I haven't thought of it quite that way, and it's interesting when you enter these worlds as a writer. This is more when I was younger. It's a magical place, whatever the qualities of the character, and you don't want to leave it. When I'm writing well, and again, this is more when I was younger than now. I'm a little too conscious of the process now, but it was. The happiest I've ever been was when I was writing these novels, and the sad part was always when the voice left, and then I had to patch up the end to make it work, because the voice always left a little too early, or the aura that the voice brought. But on the other side, in terms of the power of the real world, we live in a world in which we are very much at the mercy of vast, complex systems that we can barely understand or keep up with as they change and evolve. And to me, this has always been a source of anguish and worry and anxiety, as I think it is for a lot of people. But one way I've attempted to deal with this is exactly to enter into that kind of world and try to look at it from inside to see what it feels like. Well, you know, the moral is always power corrupts absolutely. We know that, but you need to live that in some sense to understand it. And in some area of our lives, we all have power. We all have absolute power in some small area, and we always get in trouble because of it. So that, in a sense, is what these novels with their extreme obsessive narrators are about.
You're listening to Bookworm. We'll be back talking to Stanley Crawford after this brief break. This is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Stanley Crawford about his newest book, Petroleum Man, published by the Overlook Press. Now, always, too, there's someone speaking to us, of necessity, because this is a novel, of a world that the narrator can see and we cannot. These books become, in a sense, precincts of a particular consciousness describing a world we don't yet know and know only through what he tells us. Now, in Petroleum Man, this narrator has invented the thingy, has stolen the glue for the thingy from his wife's family's formulae, then goes on to invent the thingamajig and the thingamabob. But although at times we're told that these thingies adorn lawns and Christmas trees, at other times we're told that they are organizers of personal space. And the thing that can both adorn a Christmas tree and organize personal space is, of course, not quite imaginable. I wanted to talk to you about the role of the mysterious invisible, the thing that the narrator can see but that we cannot, because they seem to define these books. There are laws and principles beyond our comprehension that make these books magical, mysterious, anti-gravity machines.
Well, I'm not certain I can quite go where you probably hope I'm going, but when I feel that I'm onto something, that I hear a voice, and it seems to be going somewhere, it's basically I'm creating a system. I'm a terrible plotter. I don't know how to plot novels. I enjoy good plots. So the plots of my novels are really the description of a system. And when the system is completely described, the book is finished. As we've talked about there are various systems and different systems in each of these novels. In Petroleum Man, the system is a combination of his family relationships and his business structure, though I don't go into his business relationships and his political relationships.
Well, what I think, in fact, also, is that the books are designed ultimately to locate the narrator in his system and then to see that the system itself encloses the narrator in loneliness. And then what moves me most about the books is the way eventually that loneliness is communicated to the reader, that we end up recognizing that we are, for some reason, all in an enclosed sphere, bounded by rules that we think we've made and that leave us apart from others. This becomes, after the extravagance of the claustrophobic space, that mystery that we die with.
Well, we are cursed with being members of an individualistic society which values individualism and all that goes with it, with talent and brilliance and so on, and eccentricity and then all the negative values. And ironically, of course, it is the novel that comes out of that individualism. Collective societies, traditional collective societies do not generate. They create ritualistic forms of art. So perhaps the novel is, you might say, the ritualism of individualism. There's another side which also interests me, which is the novel is always the exception to the rule. And this is why novels or writers in general are dangerous in totalitarian societies, because they're always writing about exceptions, weird people, whatever. And I think that value still holds very much in the society, even though it celebrates the very things that in other societies would be cause for going to jail.
Now, because Stanley Crawford has lived first on the West Coast and then in New Mexico, he is to some extent a secret. We're grateful to presses like the Overlook Press that have stepped forth as so-called commercial publishing becomes more and more hard-nosed and reticent, because his works are being brought back into the public consciousness. Overlook will be republishing his first book, Gascoigne. They've just published Petroleum Man. But I want to venture an observation that in the first two books, they're the works of a young man, and the world is being populated by invention upon invention. In the final two books, the last two books, I don't mean, I hope, by any means the final two books, the world is being depleted of possibility. And it's as if, for a reader who doesn't know this, who were to read the five books in a row, they would define an arc about the confidence in the imagination of a young writer embarking on a world that he can invent, to the sense of a world that can't be invented, that the world is too much with us, that the things that we've done to the environment, to the world, limit and enclose the imagination, so that all we can do, like this man telling about his 30 cars, is itemize, as if the books are about siphoning out the great oxygen of invention to an account book. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, because it seems to me very clear, how conscious you are of that.
Well, I'm... I think that the thing that I've been trying to get at, not through Petroleum Man, but it turned out to come that way also, was we do live in a world of, in a material world of increasing complexity of a certain kind. And on the other hand, we're creating a world, a natural world of increasing simplicity, which is dangerous. And what I think what I've tried to do with my nonfiction is to go back into that natural world, or actually properly enter it for the first time, or the semi-natural world of agriculture in particular, and begin to try to understand the incredible complexities of it. And through my fiction, I've gone into what seems to be the incredible complexity of the material world, but which is in so many cases for so many people, and certainly for me in many cases, also a desert. It's a very cold place, and it's not a place where love exists in a way that that we need it.
Yes, the last words of Petroleum Man come as the narrator is aware, finally, that he's alone in an airplane over the world, subjected to turbulence as he addresses people who don't hear him, who don't like him, who don't care about him. He begs them for the merest words spoken over the phone or scribbled on a scrap of paper or even emailed might well do it. Anything, in fact. Anything at all.
From his grandchildren, who he's somewhat estranged from by the end of the book.
But that enormous sense of the loneliness that presides over a vast vacuum, or, as you were saying, a desert.
Well, I've written or read, I'm not certain, somewhere that you go into a typical big box store and there are too many things and not enough people. You go to something like a farmer's market and you have a lot of people and you have a lot of stuff, but the proportion is right because the people there are connected with the things, with the produce, because they grew it and because they're going to buy it and eat it. We live very much in a world of things that we have no sense of the history. We have, there's no stories attached to them. They have their own, you know, they're mysterious to us. And the people who handle them, including ourselves, we know nothing about them. And yet these are works of love, in a sense, and labor by people we don't see and will never see and will never meet. And we treat them accordingly. So we treat things badly because we don't know their history, and therefore we're treating people badly who make the things. You know, the young people of Asia who are making the electronic goodies that we all love, which we will toss in a matter of years or months.
I've been speaking to Stanley Crawford, the author most recently of Petroleum Man, published by the Overlook Press, who will be republishing his earlier works. Thank you very much for joining me, Stanley.
Thank you. It's been good talking to you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My assistant here, engineer, in New Mexico, in Santa Fe, is Tim Pemberton. Production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. The jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.